The gravity of the current socio-environmental crisis compels us to re-examine the philosophical and anthropological foundations that have contributed to it. Historically, such re-evaluations have been crucial during major crises. For example, the economic and financial crisis that began in Florence in 1341, following a credit bubble burst, took over 30 years to resolve. This crisis shares notable similarities with the recent one we have faced since 2007. During that economic turmoil exacerbated by the Black Death, which swept through Europe from 1347 and killed a third of the population, there was a profound need to reconsider reality and the human condition. The Franciscan friars played a critical role during these times, urging people to humbly acknowledge their fragility and foster collaboration at all societal levels. They encouraged everyone, both rich and poor, to actively and creatively contribute to community building. Rather than supporting paternalist social assistance that is demeaning to those in need, the Franciscans played a crucial role, both theoretically and practically, in overcoming the crisis and laying the groundwork for the modern economy. In the 20th century, following the profound trauma of the two world wars, thinkers like Martin Buber and Immanuel Levinas sought to identify the grave errors in Western culture that led to the Holocaust. They argued that Western philosophy needed reformulation to prevent future tragedies. The technological advancements of the Belle Époque seemed to confirm Western civilization's perceived supremacy, which was thought to have reached an evolutionary pinnacle according to Darwin's theory of evolution. However, this era witnessed the emergence of the worst barbarisms. Levinas attributed this collapse to Western philosophy's error of placing the thinking self at the center of reality and subordinating everything else to it. Instead, he advocated for placing the you at the center, letting him remain absolutely other, independently of the thinking self. For Levinas, the encounter with the other, whose naked face evokes an ethical response, is paramount. He prioritized the ethical self over the thinking self and the ethical relationship over knowledge, thus avoiding the metaphysical, epistemological, and ethically neutral debates that had dominated Western philosophy. The fundamental relationship should be based on being one for the other rather than symmetrical reciprocity. The Church declares that the ecological crisis is a moral issue. To address it, the world needs rebirth through spiritual and ethical values, just as Levinas did in the 20th century and the Franciscans did in the 14th and 15th centuries. We must now reflect on the necessary changes in our philosophical and anthropological perspectives to restore communication and integral ecology. We must transcend our egocentrism, step out of ourselves, and focus on the situations causing Sister Earth, along with all the abandoned of our world, to cry out. In doing so, we can develop our identity as the image of the merciful God, who hears the cry of the oppressed. Francis of Assisi is a model of listening and openness to otherness. He is a universal brother, fully reconciled with God, others, himself, and creation. For this reason, the encyclical Laudato Si presents him as an example of genuine and deep respect for the integrity of creation. 1. The current economic system is unsustainable. Pope Francis has called for the creation of a fraternal and inclusive economy oriented toward the common good and attentive above all to the poor and excluded. He emphasizes that our Sister Mother Earth is among the most abandoned and maltreated of our poor. Therefore, he proposes an ecocentric economy. To promote this shift, the Pope organized an international meeting of young economists in Assisi, titled Economy of Francesco, aimed at fostering a more ecocentric economy to replace the current technocentric one, which is detrimental to life. This economy kills, he says. 1.1, everything subordinated to material progress. The current technocratic paradigm prioritizes efficiency and posits that material growth should be the primary objective of society. It relentlessly pursues material growth, sidelining relational goods or relegating them to the private sphere. People aim to maximize their well-being, companies their profits, and the state its own common good. This mentality seems to permeate all levels of social life, not just in capitalist countries. Chinese communist leaders often assert that their system is superior because it generates more material wealth for their citizens. The belief that more possessions equate to better well-being remains largely unquestioned. However, our planet cannot sustain the excessive consumption of raw materials that this growth entails. Contradicting these positions, Pope Francis asserts that less is more. In a society driven by economic growth, nature is reduced to a mere resource to be exploited for human benefit, and workers are viewed as mere human resources to be utilized in achieving production objectives. According to Bauman, ours is the first society in history to offer continuous happiness here and now. To promote this earthly happiness, it uses advertising, planned obsolescence, and easy credit, encouraging people to buy for pleasure rather than necessity. Economic freedom and independence become the foundation of all other social freedoms. The economic builds the social. Humans are portrayed as compulsive and self-interested consumers, always seeking economic gain. Economic growth becomes the primary objective. The market is even idolized, attributed with divine qualities such as omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence. If one fails to comply with market dictates, they face consequences. Understanding the market is believed to lead to understanding everything, because everything is seen as a product of economic relations. Everything is the market. We have become addicted to economic growth. This secular religion, devoid of transcendence, permeates everything. People who amass significant wealth are the new idols, as material success and achieving goals are valued more than effort, work, or attention to others. The second is the first of the losers, said a well-known public figure. The desire to be first is flaunted, compensating for the absence of fraternal relationships. Competition is seen as a ruthless struggle that enhances productivity, forgetting its etymological meaning of seeking the best solution together while reinforcing fraternal bonds. 1.2. The unsustainability of endless material growth. During the Middle Ages and the era of mercantilism, economies were structured around the control of land and natural resources. Wealth was associated with the accumulation of gold and silver as a means of increasing national power, but there was no clear priority on constant economic growth. The emphasis on growth began 2 centuries ago with the Industrial Revolution and the consolidation of capitalism, championed by economists such as Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and later John Maynard Keynes. In the 20th century, GDP became the primary measure of economic activity and national progress. Today, a defining characteristic of market economies is their reliance on continuous economic growth, which is essential to avoid high unemployment and declining investment. To maintain this growth, manufacturers must persuade consumers to purchase ever-increasing quantities of their products. The market economy would collapse if consumers stopped buying. The core issue with the market economy is that perpetual and unbounded growth is logically impossible in a finite world with limited resources. By stimulating the limitless desires of individuals rather than focusing solely on needs, the current economic system has created chronic dissatisfaction. This system requires continuous and accelerated economic growth to meet these desires and the debts that both the state and individuals are constantly incurring. Without growth, the system would collapse. However, this accelerated growth, now deemed indispensable, is depleting the planet's resources. According to the World Bank, the global economy has grown at an average annual rate of about 3% over the past few decades. This means that the global GDP doubles every 25 years, multiplying annual output by 20 in 100 years and by 40 in 125 years. To achieve this rapid growth, resource extraction has more than tripled since 1970, and by 2060, global material use could double to 190 billion tons from 92 billion, while greenhouse gas emissions could increase by 43%. The UN Environment Program concludes that we are gobbling up the Earth's resources at an unsustainable rate. Indeed, the UNEP and the International Resource Panel's 2019 affirm that the global material footprint per capita is now around 12 tons annually and, by 2050, could approach or exceed 24 tons per capita annually. Graph, global total material use by resource type. Can we maintain this rate of fossil resource extraction? OECD countries claim to have begun decoupling, which means producing without increasing the consumption of fossil resources. Circular economy concepts are discussed, but growth still takes precedence. Graph, correlation of energy consumption and GDP per person. 1.3, an economy based on desires rather than real needs. Natural resources are finite but sufficient if we use and manage them wisely. However, by prioritizing GDP growth as the primary indicator of progress, consumerism and dissatisfaction have been promoted. There will never be enough resources for the compulsive spender. The definition of economy has shifted. It used to aim at meeting needs with limited resources. Now it seeks to fulfill desires with scarce resources. We forget that limited resources may be sufficient to satisfy needs, which are also limited, unlike desires. This economic rationality proposes the axiom of non-satiation, where more is always seen as better than less, and satisfaction is never truly achieved. Consumers believe that having more is better than having less and that consuming more goods will bring more utility. They are never satisfied enough to stop desiring more, although this desire may diminish as goods accumulate. As early as 1927, Kaldrick spoke of the new economic gospel of consumption. We need a new economy focused on the real needs of people, not their desires, aiming to ensure everyone has enough to live with dignity while protecting the ecosystem. This economy should strive to guarantee full employment, as work is essential for personal fulfillment and community building. Indeed, work is a vocation and a gift of oneself, offering our talents to others. Earning more and more money must not be the primary goal, even for business enterprises. Profitability should serve as a means for a company to fulfill its social function. Growth should support these objectives, not be an end in itself. The goal is to make the world a welcoming home where everyone has what they need and can care for each other as brothers and sisters. True growth helps to overcome social inequalities and increases happiness, which is always linked to relational goods. 2. A negative anthropology. Thomas Hobbes stated that man is a wolf to man, suggesting that in the natural state, life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish. In short, Todorov notes that dominant strands of European philosophical thought assume that humans are not inherently social and thus do not fundamentally need to live in society, even if doing so is convenient. 2.1. The human being subordinated to other objectives. Both capitalism and socialism are grounded in a negative anthropological conception that contradicts the Christian perspective of the human person. Socialism subordinates the individual to the functioning of the socio-economic mechanism, rather than recognizing the person as an autonomous subject. In this system, individuals are reduced to anonymous cogs in the collective machine, an element, a molecule within the social organism. Marx aimed to overcome liberal ideology and create a new, equal society free of greed by eliminating private property and fostering human relations. He believed that individuals should view each other as integral parts of a collective whole, mediators between themselves and humanity. However, Marx did not see morality as a key force in building this new society. Instead, he viewed the economy as a meta-historical reality that underpins morality, rather than being guided by it. Capitalism, conversely, holds that a war of interests is inevitable because humans always seek to maximize their own utility in a rational and self-serving manner. It justifies stark competitiveness and predatory greed, arguing that individuals are driven by a self-preservation instinct. In this view, neighbors are not trustworthy, leading to relationships characterized by selfish individualism and mutual mistrust. Individuals are neither respected nor inclined to respect others. They are not motivated by altruism or a desire to communicate and build community. In their quest for supremacy, they see others not as brothers and sisters but as rivals to overcome, plagiarize, or assimilate. 2.2. Homo economicus. The currently prevailing technocratic ideology assumes that everyone acts logically and self-interestedly, adhering strictly to a cause-effect logic. This allows economists to predict the behavior of economic agents with precision. Consequently, in the realm of economics, people are objectified, standardized, and reduced to average individuals without specific identities. Human beings are not considered in their singularity and individuality. Instead, the focus is on the homo economicus, a selfish, utilitarian, and predictable individual, so driven by economic motivations that he is neither free nor capable of altruism. Rather than fostering trust and generosity for the common good, these economists aim only to perfect predictive mechanisms. Everything is governed by the law of large numbers. This mechanistic anthropological concept is also the fundamental error of socialism. The individual's well-being does not depend on their own decisions, as they are subordinated to the functioning of the socio-economic mechanism. Thus, the concept of the person as the autonomous subject of moral decision disappears to achieve a more humanized society in the future. These ideologies sacrifice the humanity of the individual in the present. 3. Dualistic anthropology and the abuse of nature. Modernity has accentuated the separation between humans and other creatures and has internally divided the human being by distinguishing sharply between soul and body, ontological dualism. These dualisms have underpinned the thesis of human exception, justifying a despotic and irresponsible anthropocentrism. Feeling detached from any transcendence and considering himself the absolute master of all other creatures, humanity has promoted the technocratic paradigm, the throwaway culture, and a dynamic of perpetual conflict. In Western culture, the relationship between humans and the environment has typically been interpreted through the lens of an anthropocentric ideology. During modernity, this perspective gained new momentum, advocating the absolute dominion of humans over nature and their own bodies. In the 19th century, scientism further reinforced this anthropocentrism by replacing ethical rationality with instrumental rationality, thereby paving the way for the technocratic paradigm and the throwaway culture. The current socio-environmental crisis stems from this essentialist anthropology, which internally divides humans internally and separates them from other living beings. To address this, we need to adopt an integral anthropology that does not disdain the body and overcome such unhealthy dualisms that left a mark on certain Christian thinkers in the course of history. We must transcend the ontological and ontic dualisms that have fostered a conflicting vision of reality. Humans are unitary and dialogical beings, always in communication and unable to cease this inherent dialogue. 3.1. Ontic dualism. Western philosophy has often appealed to creation or evolution to develop an essentialist anthropological conception that emphasizes the separation between humans and all other creatures. The thesis of human exception posits an ontic rupture between us and the rest of creation. This is a radical separation between human beings and other forms of life, implying that we belong to a different order of being. Consequently, humans do not attribute any rights to animals and do not feel obligated by any duties toward them. Nature is viewed as mere neutral matter without intrinsic value, entirely at our disposal. Ontic dualism was present in ancient Greece, where humans were thought to bring order out of chaos, both in the external world and within themselves. Through a challenging relationship with natural forces in their own bodies, humans were considered essentially different from other animals because they possessed logos, while other living creatures were seen as irrational. Their actions governed only by instincts or habits. Centuries later, René Descartes emphasized this dualistic separation, asserting that animals are mere machines, created by God, which are incomparably better arranged, and possess movements much more admirable than any invented by man. Thus, only human beings can communicate with each other, and this capacity distinguishes them from other creatures. Following Cartesian epistemology, the Enlightenment movement, beginning in the late 17th century, declared reason to be the essence of humanity, clearly differentiating humans from the rest of the universe. Humans were seen as rational and free, while non-human creatures were thought to operate under rigid dynamic laws. The world was not viewed as a communion of subjects but as a bunch of objects, described in mathematical and geometric terms, and defined as a clock, machine, workshop, or experiment. To understand its operation, principles of matter and movement sufficed. The works of Isaac Newton and Gottfried Leibniz, among others, reinforced this mechanical model of the world, which was observed and perceived in a functionalist and utilitarian way. Natural phenomena were explained in terms of measurable, predictable, and mechanical principles. Animals were likened to machines, seen as irrational and determined by biological mechanisms. H. Bergson stated that the thesis of human exception is the architrave of modern philosophy, at least from the Copernican Revolution onwards. However, in recent decades, the socio-environmental crisis is forcing a change in how we conceive of and relate to nature. In 2007, Schaefer announced the end of human exception. 3.2. Ontological dualism. Ontological dualism clearly distinguishes between the body and the spiritual rational dimension of humans, with the latter often considered the most authentically human. Consequently, the body is seen as subordinate to the mind or spirit. This perspective describes the human being using multiple oppositional pairs, body-soul, rationality-affectivity, need-freedom, nature-culture, instinct-morality, etc. Francis of Assisi confronted ontological dualism, which was very present in his time, notably among the Cathars. This heretical, Manichaean, and Gnostic movement despised all things visible and material, including the human body, which they believed was created by Satan, the evil god of the Old Testament. They thought the human soul belonged to an entirely different realm, created by the good God of the New Testament. Thus, the Cathars viewed the body as an undesirable prison for the soul, something material and entirely alien to it. In the 17th century, René Descartes made a clear separation between the rational soul and the body. He considered the rational soul the essence of man, characterized by his ability to think, while the body was merely a material addition, not substantially different from that of animals. Descartes believed these two dimensions of the human being came into contact through the pineal gland. The emphasis on one of these two elements gave rise to two opposing trends in the understanding of the human being, idealism and materialism, both characterized by strong dualism. Idealism focuses on rationality and neglects the corporeal dimension, while materialism reduces humans to the materiality of their bodies, viewing the body as a mere cosmic element. Indeed, the anthropocentric affirmation of modernity and the optimism of the Enlightenment coexisted with reductionist anthropologies that denied the spiritual dimension of humans and declared them prisoners of their impulses and social conditioning. According to this view, humans could be fully understood by observing their explicit behavior using the stimulus-response method. As it was assumed, they always reacted reflexively to environmental stimuli. 3.3. Domination and throwaway culture. Ontic and ontological dualisms have given rise to a tyrannical anthropocentrism, promoting both the technocratic paradigm and the throwaway culture. Even human rights, which should bolster our inherent capacity for generosity, have been diminished to mere defensive barriers protecting individuals from other human wolves. The poor and marginalized, along with our sister Mother Earth, are the first to bear the consequences of this distorted and Promethean anthropocentrism, which exalts self-sufficiency and scorns all that is fragile and vulnerable. When differences are emphasized, communication breaks down, damaging the four dimensions of ecological balance: spiritual, inner, social, and natural. On a personal level, this self-centered mindset has led to compulsive consumerism, reducing everything to insignificance, turning items into products that are quickly used and discarded. This mentality has contributed to the throwaway culture, which affects the excluded just as it rapidly turns things into rubbish. Even labor has been devalued to just another commodity, worth only the wage it provides. In forgetting its relational dimensions, labor has also lost its Christian significance as a joyful encounter with nature and a collaboration in God's creative work. 4. Promoting an ecocentric economy. The globalized economic system often separates economic activity from environmental considerations. Neoclassical economic theory has historically ignored the effects of the individualistic pursuit of immediate profit on ecosystems. Even today, people often overlook data on resource depletion and environmental degradation when calculating the gross domestic product. At best, polluting companies might face penalties proportional to the environmental damage they cause. However, this does not prevent further harm to ecosystems, as we are easily misled into believing that immediate benefits will outweigh long-term damage. Such an economy fails to enhance the population's well-being and poses a threat to sustainability. The planet's finite resources are being consumed at an unsustainable rate, rapidly turning into waste and polluting the environment. This relentless pursuit of material growth prevents sustainability through reuse or recycling. Endless economic growth is impossible with limited resources. We can no longer sustain an economic system that depletes natural resources and exacerbates inequality. Development cannot be measured solely by economic growth indicators or the amount of profit generated. It must be assessed by the collective well-being of all individuals. For new models of progress to arise, there is a need to change models of global development. It is not enough to balance, in the medium term, the protection of nature with financial gain, or the preservation of the environment with progress. Halfway measures simply delay the inevitable disaster. Put simply, it is a matter of redefining our notion of progress. We must move beyond this technocentric economic approach and adopt an ecocentric perspective that prioritizes the sustainability of natural ecosystems over their exploitation and respects the inherent limitations of natural resources. This shift would ensure that the laws governing the global ecosystems functioning take precedence over resource management practices. There are already initiatives promoting corporate social responsibility and environmental protection, such as the United Nations Global Compact Network, which serves as a positive example. Conclusion. During the 12th to 15th centuries, the Franciscan friars made significant contributions to society by promoting an economy centered on the dignity of the person and reinforcing the community. The Franciscan contribution offers valuable insights for improving contemporary economic visions. The responses of the past can guide today's search for solutions. This is not about looking back nostalgically but about orienting the future properly, considering the significant socio-economic achievements of the Franciscans during those centuries. A better economy is not found in the past but must be built in the future with everyone's creative collaboration, informed by the valuable contributions of the past. The values of prudence and justice, which form the foundation of the modern economy, need the dynamic complement of reciprocity and gratuitousness that has characterized the Franciscan economic vision. Today, we must overcome the technocentric economic approach and embrace an ecocentric vision, prioritizing the sustainability of natural ecosystems over their utility. This shift ensures that the laws governing the global ecosystem prevail over human resource management. Initiatives like the United Nations Global Compact Network, which promotes corporate social responsibility and environmental protection, are notable examples of this approach. To implement integral ecology, we can promote civically responsible consumption. It is now recognized that citizens can decisively influence the economic system by coordinating their purchasing power. This influence can be negative if consumers focus solely on cost, or positive, when they prioritize ethical considerations. The past achievements of the Franciscan friars, who put the concrete person at the center and reinforced the community, must continue today through innovative approaches that respect the environment,